Please be seated. Good afternoon. We're delighted to call the third case. We have students with us. Right? No.
No students.
All right.
Unless that front row, maybe that's all students. But other than that, I don't think so. Okay.
Emerita. I'll call our third case for today, 12-18-25-66, Stone Manufacturing, Inc. v. Lurk. Arguing on behalf of Stone Manufacturing is Charles B. Palmer. Arguing on behalf of Labor and Industry Review Committee is Anthony Cusimano. Close enough? Thank you. Mr. Palmer has 5 minutes in rebuttal. Attorney Palmer, you may proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. May it please the Court. I am Charles Palmer of Michael Best and Friedrich for the petitioner, Stone Manufacturing. The decision of the Labor and Industry Review Commission below should be vacated because the state is preempted from regulating private workplace safety, as it did in this case. In the case of Gady versus National Solid Waste Management Association, the U.S. Supreme Court stated that if a state wishes to regulate an issue of worker safety for which a federal standard is in effect, its only option is to obtain the prior approval of the Secretary of Labor, as described in Section 18 of the Act. The state is preempted from regulating private workplace safety without approval, and the state of Wisconsin has not received approval.
So what does that mean, Council? What does that mean? Does that mean that our state, our workers' comp system, of which we were the first in the country, we can't, as a state, have that anymore because the feds have preempted the field?
The feds have not preempted workers' compensation. Workers' compensation is a system in which employees receive benefits for injuries.
Right.
And that system is preserved. It may have an impact upon safety, but it is not regulation of safety.
Well, wouldn't it also have an impact on benefits?
It would have an impact on benefits, and that those benefits are preserved under the Occupational Safety and Health Act. What is preempted is regulation on subject matters that the federal OSHA regulates.
Okay.
And so
did anybody find an OSHA violation here?
There's nothing in the record that shows that OSHA regulated or issued a citation in this case.
Okay, but my question was, did anybody find an OSHA violation?
Well, yes. The Department of Commerce was commissioned by the Department of Workforce Development to conduct an inspection, and this is a regular occurrence. And the Department of Commerce agent went out, inspected the workplace, interviewed witnesses, looked at the physical property, and then in Appendix 1 to the brief, you can see the accident investigation report. And in that report, the Department of Commerce found a violation of OSHA Standard 29 CFR 1947, which is the lockout-tagout standard. In fact, they went further and actually looked at an OSHA interpretation of that standard and said that a printing industry exception that the employer was relying upon was not applicable in the case. So they did find a violation
okay.
of OSHA.
All right. Thank you.
Yes.
Mr. Palmer, didn't the investigation find a violation of the Wisconsin Safe Place Statute? 101.11 paren 1?
It did. It found both the violation of the OSHA standard and Wisconsin Safe Place Statute 101. And interestingly, 101 is very similar to what's contained in the OSH Act, which is the General Duty Clause, Section 5A1.
Which came first?
The Wisconsin Safe Place Statute came first.
Is and that then, not significant?
I think that the OSH Act may look at it and say that the OSH Act was, in fact, modeled similar to what the Wisconsin Safe Place Statute says, but I don't believe that that's significant. I believe that the federal government entered the field to regulate occupational safety and health. And the Congress declared the intent behind the Occupational Safety and Health Act was to create a uniform system of regulation and to encourage states. And this is a very important part of the Act. And you can find that in the preamble to the Act, Section 2B11, which states that the intent, one of the intents of the Act is to encourage states to the fullest extent possible to take on, apply for permission to adopt their own OSHA system and to regulate OSHA under a state scheme. And about half the states have done that. But one of the purposes was to get the states to do this. They provide grants and financial aid to assist the states in adopting their own OSHA regulations. But to the extent the state does not do that, they cannot regulate in the area of safety. So whether the Safe Place statute existed prior to OSHA, the fact is the declaration was that states can no longer do it without permission.
Well, don't you also have to look at what Justice Gableman was talking about a few minutes ago? Don't you have to look at the fact that there is a specific provision in regard to the OSHA that talks in terms of not interfering with workers' compensation laws of the states?
Yeah.
How do you resolve that with your position?
Well, Justice, so you're referring to Section 4B4 of the OSH Act, which says that workers' compensation statutes will not be altered, added to, diminished. And I reconcile that by saying, first of all, that the Safe Place statute is not a workers' compensation law. So to the extent that 101, the Safe Place statute, is being enforced by the state, it's preempted. It is not a workers' compensation law. All you have in this case is Wisconsin Statute 102.57. That statute on its own does nothing. It says that in order for it to be enforced, you have to show a violation of a statute, a regulation, or an order, something external to the Workers' Compensation Act. And those statutes are preempted. The Illinois Supreme Court looked at this similar issue with their penalty statute, and they cleaved away all of those other standards away from their safety penalty provision that was in the Workers' Compensation Act and said those can't be enforced because they are not themselves workers' comp laws, and that's in the case of Stanislavski.
Let's look then at the wording of sub 4, because, of course, it deals not only with workers' compensation law, but also statutory rights or other common law dealing with liabilities of employers. Let's read that. Nothing in this chapter shall be construed to supersede or in any manner affect any workers' compensation law or to enlarge or diminish or affect in any other manner common law or statutory law with respect to injuries, common law or statutory rights, duties, or liabilities of employers and employees under any law with respect to injuries, diseases, or death. Why isn't 101.11 a statute dealing with the liabilities of employers?
Well, 101.11 is a statute of common occurrence, and it would apply in situations where a non-employee was, for instance, injured at a
applies to frequenters. That's what you're referring to, I suppose. Frequenters?
Yes, frequenters.
That's
correct.
The language they use.
Correct.
But it also applies to employees, an employer.
As it relates, yes, Justice, as it relates to workers' compensation. But in the Ben Robinson case, the Texas Supreme Court case, which I would commend you to, there's a discussion about the intent behind Section 4B4. There's not a lot of legislative history on this. There's, say, one letter from the then Solicitor of Labor to the House that was considering the Occupational Safety and Health Act. And that letter indicated that the purpose behind Section 4B4 was merely to state that the OSH Act was not intended to create private rights of action where employees could bypass the workers' compensation system and sue. Now, the problem with the way the state poses for Section...
I'm not convinced. 101.11, Safe Place, I mean, the title is Employer's Duty to Furnish Safe Employment and Place. Now, the duty to furnish a safe place, of course, goes beyond just the employer-employee duty and goes to frequenters. But specifically, 101.11 deals with an employer's duty to furnish safe employment. So I don't understand why
Even if you can maintain the argument that this is not a workers' compensation law, why isn't it a statutory duty of employers under the law with respect to injuries, diseases, or death of employees? So why isn't it that?
Well,
why doesn't it come under that?
I think the answer is that 101, the Safe Place statute, is preempted by OSHA because Section 18B provides that a state may not regulate in an area where the federal government regulates. So to the extent that that 4B4 says what you're saying that it says, I think 18B preempts that. I think that 4B4 is a statute that exists to define the Safe Place statute, but once the OSHA Act came along, it preempted that section. I think, taken to its logical conclusion, if
why
you say,
don't we say 4B4 preempts the other provision?
Because of the Supremacy Clause. Because
4B4 says nothing in the chapter should be construed to supersede in any manner or in any manner affect workers' comp law. Why isn't that being put into effect here?
Because 4B4, if you read it that way, you can't harmonize it with Section 18B.
That's right. If you can't harmonize it for 18B, why do you say that 18B supersedes B4? I say B4 takes over 18.
Well, I think that the answer to that is that you have to look at the purpose of the Occupational Safety and Health Act. And one of the purposes, and one of them that Gady made very clear, is that if the states wish to regulate workplace safety, then they need to apply to the Federal Department of Labor and meet those minimum standards. And the whole purpose behind this was to create one uniform system and to encourage states to regulate through application to the Department of Labor. If you allow Chapter 101 to stand, if you read the statute to say that 4B4 allows the state to regulate through the Safe Place statute, if you make that argument that 4B4 trumps Section 18B, then you undermine the entire purpose of the Act that's focused on a uniform system and encouraging states to do a full OSHA.
Your interpretation, in effect, undermines all of 110.11. And the general rule is that unless the Congress has explicitly stated preemption, the presumption is it doesn't preempt. And by the savings clause here, that's what we mean by 4B4, I think, savings clause here says, hey, we don't intend to preempt. So the question is, does it fall under B4, or you would say it falls under point 18, but that's not what B4 says. And the presumption is, you don't say it explicitly, preemption doesn't cover.
Well, if we look back to the decision of the U.S. Supreme Court, which is the premier decision on OSHA preemption, the Gady Court looked at the question of whether or not the states could regulate workplace safety. And they looked at the purpose and said that Section 18B was meant to encourage employers to meant to encourage states to adopt their own safety regulation system. And if you allow 101, if you allow 4B4 to preserve the Safe Place statute, the Workers' Compensation Act, then the state has no incentive to create its own system under the approval of OSHA. They could adopt a full set of regulations like OSHA. They could interpret differently than OSHA. They could inspect. They could issue penalties. And those things would all be just like OSHA, and it would undermine that purpose of the Occupational Safety and Health Act, which is to encourage the states, under the authority of the Department of Labor, apply for their own system, meet those standards, be overseen by OSHA. And if you allow 10257 to stand, the state can do its own mini-regulation. They can get the interpretation wrong, and there's no evidence in this case that the interpretation that the state applied of the OSHA standard was correct.
What is your argument that 10257 is an occupational health and safety regulation?
Well, the Daniels case this court decided specifically said that the legislative objective is plainly to put upon the employer the duty of providing safety appliances of a certain standard and to penalize those who fail to conform. It is hoped that such a penalty will promote compliance with the regulation. I think the statement in Daniels is pretty clear that this is regulation.
This started in 1913, 2 years after the enactment of workers' comp. Let me see what that language was. I think then it said, where injury is caused by the failure of the employer to comply with any statute of the state or any lawful order of the Industrial Commission, compensation provided in sections, and they state the sections, shall be increased by 15%. That's the genesis, and there hasn't been a big change in that law since it was enacted in 1913. But now you're saying it is a occupational health and safety regulation.
Well, there has been a change, and in fact, that language you just read existed in 1970 when the OSHA Act came in. It was amended after that point to state statute, order, or rule of the department. The statute you just read would say state statutes, but the state statutes, and this is telling about what the state has interpreted, the state statute that allowed the Department of Commerce to regulate prior to 1970, 101.0215, that at the time said that the state could regulate. In 1975, that was amended to add language that said that the state could no longer regulate in private sector workplace safety. The Industrial Commission regulations that existed in 1970 when the OSHA Act passed were contained in IND Chapter 1. Those were amended to COM, to Diller 32, then to COM 32, and now are contained in SPS 332. Those are entitled Public Employee Safety and Health. The scope of that section is defined as the provisions of this chapter apply to all places of employment and public buildings of a public employer. The purpose stated in that regulatory section is establishing minimum occupational safety and health standards for public employees. So the state itself has acted to redefine the statute and the administrative code as only applying to public employers. And, in fact, the state itself, in the Attorney General's brief in its footnote 5, admits that the state cannot regulate in this way. It says, it remains true that neither LURC nor other state agencies may engage in investigation for purposes of regulating. So the state itself has admitted that it cannot regulate in this area.
Mr. Palmer, a couple minutes ago you talked to us about the Gade case from the U.S. Supreme Court. One of the cases that I looked at from the U.S. Supreme Court is the Goodyear versus Miller case, which comes from the state of Ohio. And in that case, the U.S. Supreme Court was looking at the additional award provisions of Ohio's workers' compensation law. And basically, their holding was no problem, no preemption. It seems to me that 102.57 is very similar to what they had in the state of Ohio. And it strikes me, at least on the surface, that the Goodyear case should control here in terms of the lack of preemption. How do you answer that?
Okay, so the Goodyear case is a different statute. It's a different statutory scheme altogether.
What's the Ohio statute, right?
And it's a federal statute. And in that case, they were looking at the Supremacy Clause, and the question was asked whether on public land the workers' compensation laws could be brought into play. And in that case, there was a specific federal statute that essentially waived the federal government's supremacy and said the workers' comp laws could be applied in the full measure that they would be applied as if they were being applied to a state agency. So there was an enabling statute that essentially relaxed the supremacy clause in that case. One of the things the court looked at in that case was the question of whether the safety penalty was a workers' compensation law. And the court decided not to decide whether that occurred. They basically said, look, the full measure of the statute is allowing this, and it's so clear that preemption does not have to apply. But one thing it did say is that the definition of workers' compensation is not infinitely elastic. So they were cognizant of the fact that this safety penalty thing, you know, was kind of pushing the edge in terms of whether it was a safety regulation. The other thing that's important to note in that case is they made very clear that what was being regulated was workplace safety unrelated to radiation hazards. I think it's telling in that case that they pointed out that they weren't talking about regulating radiation hazards on this nuclear power plant site. Because, of course, there's nuclear regulatory issues out there that would have federal subject matter potential preemption effect. And so this case, Goodyear, is really about the state regulating and geography of the government, physical plant of the government, whereas the case we're dealing with here is really subject to Gatey. It's an OSHA preemption case when we're talking about subject matter. And so it's different than what was in existence in Goodyear. That statute, by the way, was pretty broad. It said states shall have power and authority to apply such laws to all lands and premises owned or held by the U.S. in the same way and to the same extent as if said premises were under the exclusive jurisdiction of the state. Very broad statute. So they didn't have this OSHA preemption statute that was basically saying that the state cannot regulate where the federal government already regulates. It's a different animal altogether.
Mr. Palmer, were you done answering Justice Crooks's question? Mr. Palmer, it seems to me you're going about addressing the question one way. I'd like to try it a different way, and I'd like to refer to two statutes and then some pertinent facts from this case and then ask you how it all somehow OSHA has preempted the field and prevents recovery of the 15% of this. We look at the modern day. We look at the current 102.57. As we all know, if injury is caused by the failure of the employer to comply with any statute, rule, or order of the department, compensation and death benefits 15%, not to exceed $15,000. And then I look at 101.11, employer's duty, 101.11 sub 1, employer's duty to furnish safe employment and place. Every employer shall furnish employment which shall be safe for the employees therein, and shall furnish a place of employment which shall be safe for employees and for frequenters thereof, and shall furnish and use safety devices and safeguards, and shall adopt and use methods and processes reasonably adequate to render such employment and places of employment safe, and shall do every other thing reasonably necessary to protect the life, health, safety, and welfare of such employees and frequenters. Now, the facts, as I understand it, involve the employee following the direction of her employer, cleaning the press while it was moving in slow motion. That was how she was trained, right? That's what the facts indicate.
She was trained by another employee to do that, yes.
Well, that's a was there any other way that was followed in the plant?
The employer's presentation was that it was to be left on but not running, and so she had it running slowly as she was working at it. But
okay, so she's got it on, and she's got it running slowly. She gets her hand caught up to the wrist, causing significant damages. How is that not a violation of 101.11? And why doesn't that then trigger 102.57? And how does OSHA preclude any of that?
Well, because it is regulating the lockout tagout standard, de-energization
equipment. Which they are. The department and their ALJs are permitted, as I understand it, to look to OSHA guidelines for direction or for factors to be considered. Yes, they can consider them.
Well, they believe they can. Our argument is that they cannot regulate in that way because they're regulating a standard in which OSHA
I thought your answer was going to be more to, yeah, they can consider them, but they can't apply. But you're saying no. You can't even look to see what the ALJ can't even look to see what OSHA guidelines are.
Yes, and the reason I say that is OSHA puts out its own statement as to what it considers to be state regulation that's preempted. And I apologize, we did not cite this to the Supreme Court, but we did cite it in the Court of Appeals. You can find it on OSHA.gov. And it's a provision that says what OSHA thinks is regulation, and they include inspection, they include sanctions, they include enforcement provisions. And so all of those things are considered to be regulation by OSHA. Well, then those are preempted. And because the Section 18B says the state cannot regulate in matters that OSHA regulates.
What does that interpretation do to 101.11?
It wipes it away. 101.11 does not exist.
That's
as
what I
it
thought.
Relates to private workplace right. safety. It can still exist with respect to public workplace safety, but it does not continue to exist after OSHA. It can
so
exist.
So necessarily 102.57 has to fall too? That gets wiped clean, as you say?
We submit that it does because it is regulating private workplace safety.
There are other things that 101.11 regulates besides things that OSHA regulates.
Correct.
Right? How high the stairs are and the length of the tread and all sorts of things. You can argue that a building was constructed in a way that it is physically not safe to work in, right?
And with respect to non-employees, that may stand. 101
but not, may stand. Not in regard to employees.
Correct.
So there's nothing under 101.11 that applies to employees.
Not in the private sector. Unless you come back to Section 18A of the OSHA Act, which says that if the OSHA doesn't regulate, then the state may regulate. So there could be things that still apply. And the intent here was that as OSHA picked up and grew, the state's regulation would diminish. And so as OSHA expanded their regulations, remember the day after the OSHA Act was passed, and I see that my time is up here.
Go ahead.
The day after the OSHA Act was passed, of course, there were no regulations. So OSHA was regulating nothing. Everything stayed the same under the state. 102.57 could still exist, but as OSHA has begun to regulate in those areas, it has grown, and the state must necessarily step aside under Section 18B of the Act. So 101 can still exist with respect to matters that OSHA doesn't regulate. That's provided by Section 18A of the Act. And 101.11 can still exist with respect to non-employees
frequent.
And public employees. Yes.
Well, public employees has its own drill, though, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So we're not – that's a whole different kettle of fish than we're looking at
right.
today. Now, is – in your view, is – citing an employer or finding a violation of OSHA a part of regulation?
Yes.
Okay, so if there were no ability to cite for a violation of OSHA, then is there anything else that would even bring up the Safe Place Act? Just forget that. So you can't do that, so we're taking that out of the mix. Then what does that do to 101.11 in this case?
Wipes it away.
101.11 it falls by the wayside.
Right, because that is that's the statute that's claimed to have been violated in order to trigger 101.11, right?
102.57, correct.
Okay, 102.57. Thank you.
Yes.
So without that bootstrap to get you in there, so if you can't take the first step, according to your theory, you can't take any of the steps that have been taken.
Right.
Okay. Thank you. That helps.
Chief, if I may. Mm-hmm. 101.11 falls by the wayside. 102.57 falls. Does 102.58 also fall under your argument? Is 102.58 preempted by federal law?
Thank you, Justice. 102.58, of course, that provides that employees' benefits might be reduced if an employee committed an unsafe act by rules of the employer, by drug and alcohol use. So it could, 102.58 could fall by the wayside if, for example, the employee's benefits were reduced by 15% as a result of violating an OSHA standard or doing something that is regulated by OSHA. Of course, OSHA doesn't regulate drug and alcohol.
That's
so
right.
Certainly the penalty could apply in that case. The state could also regulate employers with respect to drug and alcohol testing, as the state does in public works contracts. It requires employers to adopt drug and alcohol testing policies. OSHA is not regulating that. But there is a case that the Doig case that the U.S. Supreme Court decided, and many of you may remember this case, where the deep tunnel explosion occurred in Milwaukee, and there was a prosecution of the general project manager under the OSH Act, and the question was whether you could prosecute an individual. And in that case, the Supreme Court said that the OSH Act applies only to companies, not individuals. So 10258 might not be preempted because in this situation, if you're regulating an employee, that's not the same as regulating an employer under the OSHA Act.
10258 starts with the language, if injury is caused by the failure of the employee to use safety devices that are provided, and of course there are other situations too, but if there's a safety device that would be a safety device that falls within the purview of OSHA, then that falls by the wayside. That part of 10258 falls, you think?
I think that could be the correct reading, yes. Yes.
Any other statute that falls before you want to sit down?
You know, we're going to go from six volumes to five and a half pretty soon.
No, I think 10257, 10258, those are the ones that fall within 18B because it has the state regulating in a subject matter that the federal government regulates. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Rosamano, the Assistant Attorney General representing LURC.
May it please the Court. My name is Anthony Rosamano. I represent Labor and Industry Review Commission, or LURC, which is the respondent in this case. LURC believes this case primarily believes this case may turn on a fairly straightforward analysis based on OSHA's savings provision. As this Court has noted, that provision is quite broadly worded to cover any workman's compensation law and explains that it shall not be affected in any manner. We believe that the 10257, which is the statute under which LURC has power here, is plainly a workers' compensation law. Because of that, we think the analysis really just has those two steps. There is a broad savings provision for workers' compensation. This is a workers' compensation law. And that would end the inquiry, especially given that the preemption burden, it goes the other direction. That is, the assumption is the law is valid unless there's a clear indication that Congress intended to preempt. We believe.
Well, my understanding is that there was a determination that there was a violation of an OSHA standard. And it was that violation that was then used to trigger 10111. And then from there, once that is triggered, you get to the penalty provisions that is kind of the absolute end focus of what we're doing. If you can't have an OSHA violation, unless OSHA makes the finding, how do you end up getting into the penalty provision that you're referring to?
Well, Your Honor, the 10257, which is the provision that increases the compensation,
yep,
is triggered by any statute. So at least the wording is any statute. So one such statute would be 10111, but there could be other statutes perhaps.
Okay. But where's the violation of 10111 if you don't have an OSHA violation that you can lean on?
In this case, the only evidence of a violation was of an OSHA regulation.
Okay.
In other cases, perhaps there could be evidence of some kind of safety violation apart from OSHA that would also trigger the increased compensation.
I understand that. What I'm having a problem with is the argument that you can use an OSHA violation as the first step to get into 10257. If OSHA had made a citation and cited the employer for a violation and then you used it, I wouldn't have a problem. But OSHA didn't make any kind of finding here. And don't you think that determining that OSHA was violated and making that step number one really has the state regulating?
Well, Your Honor, we don't think so. And because LURC here isn't, in the sense that I think the Gade case discusses, regulating in that it's imposing a requirement on an industry or company in a day-in and day-out way, saying you have to do this, we're going to see if you're doing it, we are perhaps going to fine you if you're not doing it. LURC only gets involved when there's a workers' compensation claim, and that claim is based on an injury that was caused by a safety violation, and then LURC's only power is to increase compensation. So
what if OSHA wouldn't have found a violation here? What if their inspector came through and they wouldn't have agreed with the state's determination that there was a violation here?
Well, Your Honor, I think how it would have played out is this. The way that the report, the investigation report by the then Department of Commerce was an exhibit at the ALJ hearing, the DWD hearing in the first stage of this proceeding. Mm-hmm. SOAM could have come forward with contrary evidence, or, for example, that OSHA did not find a violation. That very well may have prevailed. If it didn't prevail, they could have sought judicial review and argued that it should have. So it could have been a back and forth or a contrary position taken by SOAM. They did not challenge the safety violation in this case or suggest it wasn't there.
No, what's being argued here is that you didn't have the right to make that determination, that had to be made by OSHA folks, not by state employees, correct? I mean, that's what I understand the argument to be.
I believe that's Soane's argument.
Okay.
Yes.
And do you think that having a finding in a proceeding that there was an OSHA violation is not part of regulation? Is that what your argument is?
That's one of our arguments, yes, Your Honor. We don't believe it's regulation because it's only being done in a very limited way to increase or decrease compensation. And I might add, even if it were, in a sense, regulation,
right.
We believe the OSHA savings clause would make that a non-issue because it saves it anyway. And the Goodyear Atomic case kind of discusses the same scenario where they take a pass on whether something is a regulation and say, it doesn't matter, it's saved. So Congress might generally wish to preempt stuff like this or regulations if this is a regulation, but not these, because they said we're not going to preempt any workers' compensation provision. So we think that ultimately the regulation question need not be answered because of the savings clause. But if this court were to approach it, we believe that this is not the kind of regulation contemplated by GAID, which is the state coming in, having an entity that actually imposes requirements on an industry every day. Like, this is what you must do, and we can then see if you're doing it and fine you. Whereas LURC, only power LURC has here is when they're approached with a workers' compensation claim, they may then increase compensation. And then that's the only power.
But they're basing it on a factual finding that OSHA was violated. And they made that factual finding themselves. OSHA didn't. And that's kind of what's bothering me. So I understand that you don't think that's regulation, and I'll give it more consideration. I read Goodyear. I think it's a different statute. At least that's kind of how I look at it.
But well, the administrative law judge said that the employee's injury was caused by the employer's failure to comply with OSHA and the Safe Place Statute. Therefore, liable for a safety violation within 102.57. LURC's decision said, in its reading of GLAID, that someone's argument was unavailing, that in prior cases before the circuit courts, the court concluded that the GAID language is broad and that the Wisconsin Safe Place Statute was in existence long before OSHA, and using the OSHA regulation to serve as the standard for measuring liability under 101.11, as applied in 102.57, doesn't necessarily violate the preemption. The circuit court stated that the trial court held that SOAM violated the Safe Place Statute regardless of the OSHA standard, and that Safe Place is independent of that. So another way of answering the question is, if the ALJ and LURC seem to rely on OSHA for the safety standard, can the circuit court and then the Court of Appeals and us say, hey, they're not relying on OSHA? Well, the ALJ did rely on OSHA. Now, it also said Safe Place Statute, but it seemed to me that they're relying on OSHA. So no matter how you cut it, you've got one, on one hand, reliance on OSHA as a safety standard. And OSHA says, hey, preemption on safety regulations. On the other hand, he got workers' comp in under 10257 and Safe Place, which is workers' comp, deals with workers, with employers in this, and safety of employees. So the question is, which one trumps? Which one is superior? Which one is stronger?
Which avenue to
trigger? Yes, but because you have to concede that you got OSHA and you got Safe Place and you got workers' comp, right?
Yes, all three have been in play in this case.
That's right. So then you have to decide which one takes precedence, which one trumps the other. If you say it's workers' comp trumps the other two, then you're home free under the Safe Place statute. I'm sorry, under the Savings Clause. If you say that OSHA trumps, because that was the holding here of the ALJ, then you might say the workers' comp statute falls by the wayside, the Savings Clause falls by the wayside. Because you don't have a clean one or the other here.
Your Honor, yeah, and what I believe maybe part of your question is there more than one way to affirm here?
Well, that's the way you'd like to put it. You can answer. You can answer that. I'm saying that both of you have trouble. Both Sohn Manufacturing has trouble, and Lurk has trouble, because what you have here in play are both workers' comp and a violation of OSHA. And you don't have a state statute saying that you needed that safety measure. Otherwise, it's a violation of the law.
Yeah, I think I understand your question, Your Honor. And I think the Goodyear Atomic case is helpful in this regard. There, the U.S. Supreme Court discussed that workers' compensation statutes can sometimes take into consideration more than just no-fault kind of default rule, and can take into consideration improper acts or safety violations. And the U.S. Supreme Court mentioned 15 states that take into consideration misconduct or bad acts, and 8 states that take into consideration safety violations. And the U.S. Supreme Court explained that workers' compensation laws have traditionally been more expansive and do include things like consideration of misconduct or safety violations when adjusting compensation out of a sense of perhaps fairness when someone's due more or due less. Because of the circumstances. And the Goodyear Atomic case pointed out that, and I think maybe this is the tension the Court's discussing, is that maybe that does have an indirect effect on the employer, that they don't want to, they feel penalized, and maybe that encourages them to do better because they have to pay a little more money, 15%, up to $15,000. But that indirect effect does not change the analysis because Congress spoke in the Goodyear Atomic case and in OSHA and in broad terms preserving workers' compensation laws, including these other additional types of adjustments that come with some states' workers' compensation laws. So I think that you can have both because of this broad savings clause.
Well, now you can answer a question you posed. How, under what theories can you affirm the Court of Appeals here or, in effect, Lurk?
Well, Your Honor, The way that Lurk articulated its opinion, and I believe the Court of Appeals, is that what triggered 10257 was the Safe Place statute, and the evidence of that violation was the OSHA violation. There's no other evidence discussed, just the OSHA violation. So it could be that you go through the Safe Place statute, and the OSHA is pulled in through the Safe Place statute. Perhaps if this court thought it was proper, you could go straight and say, look, there's evidence of OSHA violation. That's any statute under 10257, and that could trigger it. And that's not the way the case has been argued, but it could be an alternative way of looking at it.
Well, they said that OSHA is evidence of unsafe practice or unsafe condition.
Yes.
That's a distinction I'm trying to sorry, are you done?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. That's a distinction I'm trying to wrestle with. Is the violation of a safety provision that you're relying on the violation of the Safe Place statute, or is the violation of the safety provision that you're relying on a violation of an OSHA standard?
Well, Your Honor, I think maybe both. That the Safe Place statute requires safe workplace.
Okay.
And the unsafe thing here was the finding that OSHA was violated. We talk about it in terms of evidence of an OSHA violation in the sense that it was an exhibit and Stone could have come forward with contrary evidence that OSHA was not, it wasn't a per se kind of thing.
So anytime the safe place statute is violated, there's the 15% penalty?
No, Your Honor, with the caveat that it would have to be true that there's a workers' compensation claim and injury, and the injury was caused by that safety violation. So you would only have the circumstance, you could have all kinds of safety violations but never come before LURC until there's a claim caused by that violation.
So it has to be a safety violation.
Yes, that's how the statute
is. Is the safety violation here the OSHA violation?
That was the only
So it's not just
violation
the safe, a violation of the safe place statute, it's a safety violation.
I think if I understand you correctly, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. I see 10257 and 10258 as kind of, you know, the spider in the mirror. They sort of hold each other accountable. And 10257 is if the employer violates a statute. 10258 deals with when the employee fails to use safety devices. And either way, it creates this reduction or increase based upon that failure to follow that. What kind of OSHA standard could be used against the employee for purposes of decreasing compensation under 10258? Or is it just a one-way street on that one?
Well, Your Honor, this is just my reading of the statute. I understand it to say that where there's a regulation that's applicable, could be an OSHA regulation, the employee is given the tools to follow it but does not, then that would trigger 10258 so that if that would be a way to get there.
I mean, OSHA standards generally, as I understand them, an employee can violate an OSHA standard, but in the end it falls on the employer's shoulders. The employer is penalized, not the employee. Employers can't push it off and say, you know, the employee was at fault here.
I believe that's how OSHA would be applied.
So really, an OSHA violation is only going to fall on the shoulders of an employer. So,
for OSHA's enforcement, yes, but compensation could be reduced. OSHA could be in play because compensation could be reduced when an employee is given the tools to follow OSHA and doesn't. So it would be a part of the analysis. It wouldn't be necessarily determinative, maybe.
What do you think of 29 U.S.C. 653b4 that says nothing in this chapter shall be construed to enlarge or diminish or affect in any other manner the common law or statutory rights, duties, or liabilities of employers and employees under any law with respect to injuries, diseases, or death of employees arising out of or in the course of employment?
We read that as essentially a broader savings language in the first clause of that subsection. So, in other words, it would encompass things like workers' compensation and other things that states might have that provide rights to employees or or other people who might be infected by these workplaces. It seems to be an effort by Congress to make sure they didn't miss anything, is how we would read it. To leave the status quo in states in place as when OSHA was enacted.
Counsel, if I understood your response to Justice Eagler, is it your position that a violation of OSHA, so long as it pertains to safety, which most of them do, that per se that will be a violation of 10111?
I didn't mean to say that, Your Honor.
I'm asking. That's what I heard, but I don't know.
No, we would this violation of OSHA could perhaps be a contested factual issue. But if OSHA were violated, that would seemingly be evidence of a safe place violation because it's a safe. It would be at that point. Established a safety violation occurred.
That your answer is actually yes, because of course my question is premised not on some unfounded allegation, but on a proven violation of an OSHA regulation pertaining to safety. And in that case, which of course is the case that I was asking about, it per se violation of safe place?
Seemingly be hard to argue otherwise.
Really? How would you argue that that's not bootstrapping an OSHA regulation from the federal government, one designed to ensure that employers who provide places of employment for their employees make their places of employment as safe as possible by following a set of very, very specific, very, very finely detailed prescriptions and proscriptions with its own set of regulation and enforcement, and then the scheme set up to penalize the employer. I assume, too, that they work with employers if it's depending on the violation. How is that not bootstrapping a regulation from a federal program, from OSHA, and applying it to a very different statutory scheme, which is 10111 and workers' compensation?
Well, Your Honor, I suppose I don't disagree with your premise that it's being used in a different sort of statutory scheme, an OSHA violation, and it's being used to adjust compensation. We think that's okay because it's not, in fact, enforcing OSHA on that company. LURC cannot make the company follow OSHA's regulations. There's no prospective power. The company can ignore as many regulations as they like. If the day comes when one of those causes an injury to an employee and they look for compensation, that's when LURC gets involved. So we think that difference is not bootstrapping in the sense that it would be a regulation and impermissible.
So the OSHA violation here, tell me specifically, the lock and tag was not followed. The OSHA regulation that says if you're going to maintain or clean equipment, you must either lock out or remove the power source and then place some sort of physical tag so that nobody else, by accident, starts the machine up, thereby potentially causing damage to the operator. That's
essentially my understanding. Anyone else, or the person cleaning it, might turn it on and get their hand caught accidentally, move it forward in a way that injures them.
Sure. But, well, okay. So how would that fit into, do we know how OSHA would penalize that? I mean, is there a warning to be given first? Is there a procedure that OSHA follows before it fines, before it actually penalizes an employer for something like that?
Well, the short answer is I don't have a clear answer for you, Your Honor, but my understanding of just reading OSHA's powers is they do have steps they can follow. So I take it, depending on the violation in history, they could just warn.
Why limit it to OSHA? Why not look to all government regulations, federal and state, and say, gee, if any of them pertain to safety, why, surely a violation of that would be a violation of safe place statute.
Well, just perhaps you could, but the only way it would come up is if that violation caused an injury. So we wouldn't be talking about this unless that whatever that violation might be actually hurt somebody. So that would somewhat limit the pool of things that could trigger LURC being involved.
But it wouldn't limit the number of government agencies that could be scoured for a source of recovery.
Perhaps so, Your Honor. I'm not aware of other agencies that would be as relevant as OSHA, but OSHA.
I bet if we took about 15 minutes, we could find seven. All right. Thank you.
Yeah. Counsel, in the statutes or in the regulations, are there lists of what is unsafe or what would violate the safe place statute?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor, no.
So, to say, so if you have a safe place violation, that is, if you have a claim against an employer for a safe place violation, you'd have to show that it's unsafe. And to show that it's unsafe, you might go to a federal law that says it's unsafe as evidence of it being unsafe. You might go to various materials in the literature that shows it's unsafe. We had a case which was a slip and fall case. It was a safe place statute. And it was accumulation, anyway, accumulation of ice. And there was a slip and a fall. And the question was, is that a violation of the safe place statute? And there I just assume that you use common sense that if there's an accumulation of ice and snow, it's not very safe. And there are ordinances that say you can't let it accumulate. I'm making this up somewhat. You can't let it accumulate for more than 1 hour or 1 inch or something like that. So you look to all of that, I assume, for what is as evidence of safe place, or what's safe, right?
I believe you could, Your Honor, yes.
All right. And your position is that's what they did with OSHA. They looked, they used OSHA as evidence.
Yes.
Even though the ALJ didn't say that.
I believe that, I guess, reading the decision in context of what was before the ALJ, that's how we understand the ALJ to have ruled, though.
Well, from what I heard you say, you don't, the OSHA or LURC didn't use it as evidence. They used it as dispositive, per se.
Well, in this case, that was the only evidence presented. If someone could have presented, as LURC mentioned in its decision, I believe, could have presented other evidence saying this was not a violation.
But you're saying, I'm sorry,
I
interrupted
yes.
the Chief Justice's line of questioning only because I didn't understand your agreement to her proposition. So I'll stop.
Can I ask one point of clarification? Are you saying that they use the OSHA regulations as evidence that there was a failure to exercise ordinary care?
They use as evidence that it wasn't a safe workplace under the safe place statute.
Right. Well, what's the standard? I mean, you have to prove negligence, right? I didn't mean to take far down the line, but I'm just saying, did they use that as evidence of breaching the safe place statute, or was it one of those that's like per se a violation of the safe place statute
per se?
There's a difference. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah,
like, oh, gosh, you know, these are the standards in the industry, and you didn't follow standards in the industry, and so that's proof of a safe place violation. Or did you use it that because you violated this standard, per se, you violated the safe place statute?
No per se language was used in the decisions, and it worked out that this was the only evidence of unsafety. I don't know if there could have been other evidence that wasn't true. I don't know if that answers your question.
Go ahead.
Counsel, you have different categories. You have a 10257 violation. And how is that proven? Now, I don't know exactly how it's proven, but this is my understanding. Part of the Department of Workforce Development is a building and safety division. And the building and safety division oftentimes does a investigation, and then they write a report. In fact, they use a form sometimes much akin to the kind of report, which is a WC-16B, that doctors would use in a workers' compensation case. So you have someone from the Building and Safety Division doing an investigation to see if there's a violation. Then they file this form. WC something form or some kind of form. And that is, I think there are rules that admit that into evidence, but of course the other side can bring other evidence and you could have witnesses if you want, but you don't need to, just like in workers' compensation cases, you don't need to call the doctor. You can just use that report as evidence of a violation. Is that the procedure used here?
I believe that's largely accurate, Your Honor, and the statute for using investigation reports as evidence is WSSTAT 102.17, sub 1, sub H.
Yeah, and so it's the report, and it's just like the WC-16B of a doctor who doesn't come to testify, but you could call the doctor, you could subpoena him, both sides can put on people. Okay, so that's the 102.57. Then you have like 101.11, which is its own statutory scheme. And then you have ordinary negligence. Now, we have, in ordinary negligence, we have all sorts of cases that say violation of the safety statute is negligence per se. Oftentimes that arises, for instance, in automobile accidents. You know, someone's speeding, clearly speeding. Violation of a safety statute, the speed statute, is negligence per se. So I think it's important that we keep these things all separate. And it seems to me that sometimes in the responses, things are getting confused. Maybe I'm wrong, but with regard to a violation of an OSHA standard, under 102.57, is that considered under the workers' compensation law negligence per se? Show me in the workers' compensation law where that would be negligence per se. I don't think you can.
I don't believe that language is used.
So that concept isn't within 102.57 action. That may be within our ordinary negligence, you know, violation of a safety statute is negligence per se. It may be even argued under a 101.11 action, but not in 102.57 necessarily. Maybe I'm wrong. I want you to test me on this. I mean, correct me if I'm
No, I believe that's right, Your Honor. And I think that returns the idea that LURC isn't applying any other statute in the first instance. They're not purporting to apply the Safe Place statute in some freestanding way. Really what they're doing here is just making a computation and deciding, the legislature decided you should take into consideration something that seems wrong. I apologize, I'm out of time.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the legislature, because don't we have to take the legislature at its word? 102.57 lists out the three avenues that someone may pursue, upon which someone may pursue the additional 15% up to 15,000. They all relate to state statute, order, or administrative rules. Doesn't your interpretation that you're asking us to adopt add, as well as OSHA and apparently any other governmental regulatory bureaucracy violations?
Well, Your Honor, just to begin with, 102.57, it says any statute. It doesn't explicitly say it has to be a state statute. So that maybe that's something.
So you think that would encompass the federal code?
Potentially. It's not something that we briefed in this case, because the 101.11 was involved, the Safe Place statute, and there was no dispute that there was a Safe Place violation. The question was, could the increase be imposed?
But the Safe Place violation was grounded in the OSHA violation, correct?
Right. So
it's really, without the OSHA violation, you wouldn't have had a Safe Place violation, right?
In this case, there was no additional finding for a Safe Place, right?
But it's not because of the statute. It's because of the evidence that was or was not introduced.
Yes, Your Honor. Perhaps you could have a standalone Safe Place violation, but that wasn't discussed as something standalone here.
Could have brought in evidence that studies have shown that unless you stop these machines before you put your hand in, you're going to have a problem.
Perhaps.
And that you should instruct employees that they should stop the machine, and there should be big signs that say, stop the machine before you do such and such, right? So there could be other evidence here.
Yes.
It just wasn't.
That's correct, yes.
So every time there's a Safe Place violation, this 15% provision is in play?
If it causes a worker injury that leads to a claim, then it could be, yes. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Palmer.
I think at the end of the analysis, this court needs to look at the decision in the Gady case and what the Supreme Court said in Gady. And specifically, we cite this at page 17 of our brief. Any state law requirement designed to promote health and safety in the workplace falls neatly within the Act's definition of an occupational safety and health standard. This court has said in Daniels that the purpose of this penalty provision is to prompt employers and require employers to comply or suffer the consequences.
Counsel, there will be no additional charge for the damage done to our family. But I do have a question. I do have a question. And that is, does it really come down? There were at least four different questioners on this bench, myself included, through a process of our colloquy with your opposing counsel, it seemed to me we were winnowing it down to the difference between evidence and per se dispositive proof of a violation. So in other words, as I understand it, Lurk is allowed to use as evidence, as a consideration, whether the alleged safe place violation constituted a violation of OSHA standards. Is that fair enough to say?
Yes.
Well, unlike a doctor's letter or any other witness's testimony, those are not dispositive, all of which can be introduced into evidence. Does it really come down to semantics? But I suppose it's a distinction with a great difference. At least it seems that way. What's permitted? The circuit courts of our state are instructed that what may be introduced into evidence is anything that may tend to lead to probative value for a relevant fact in controversy. Okay? So as a circuit court judge for 6 years, I made all sorts of evidentiary rulings, allowed thousands of items of evidence in. I don't remember one piece of evidence being a legally dispositive one. Have you addressed that in your brief? Have you found any cases or sites that would discuss that distinction?
Well, I think the focus the court and all the questioners have placed on this is how does the evidence get into the record and what weight to put upon the evidence. The question, I think, that the court needs to focus on is not how the evidence gets into the record, but whether there was regulation. Because as the court in Gady said, any state requirement designed to promote health and safety in the workplace falls neatly within the Act's definition of occupational safety and health standard. In order to regulate, the state has to adopt its own program under the approval of OSHA. So if they're regulated, and the question is this regulation? I think the Daniels case answers that question. Clearly, it is regulation. They're engaged in penalty in order to make sure an employer will comply. And so there is regulation. My client, or our client in this case, certainly felt regulated. Somebody shows up from the Department of Commerce, knocks on the door, comes in, does an inspection, issues a report saying you violated an OSHA standard. That's handed to the DWD, and the DWD says pay or appeal. That, in our view, is regulation, and that, by the way, in the view of OSHA.
OSHA doesn't always automatically issue a fine or a forfeiture, does it? OSHA works with employers, at least from time to time, to try to correct.
Well, OSHA has a couple of different fronts. Well, they have a compliance division, and they actually provide funding to the state to help employers comply, and there's a state agency that will help with
that. For education as well as remediation.
But when OSHA inspects, if they find a violation, the penalties are for a serious violation up to $7,000, for a willful violation up to $70,000. But more importantly, in that OSHA inspection and citation, there's an abatement requirement. It sets a certain date. You've got to correct this violation. The concern here, and that brings us to a concern here with respect to allowing the state to do what it's doing, which is they come in, they do this inspection, they issue a penalty as a result of the alleged safe place or the OSHA violation. The employer can pay it. As the state argues, well, it's not really regulation because they're not requiring any kind of abatement. Well, I would submit to this court that's a problem because that can lead an employer to believe that, well, I pay this penalty, I was regulated, that's what I have to do. And that undermines the remedial purpose of the Occupational Safety and Health Act because...
You're talking about factoring it into the cost of business?
Sure. But my point is that you don't have that remedial aspect of this mini OSHA activity that the state is engaging in.
And what you're doing is you're going back to your opening argument, which has to do with the fact that there's no proscriptive prospective application as it would be applied, as an OSHA violation would be applied through LERC.
And that's actually conflict between what the state is doing and what the OSHA Act requires.
Are you arguing that they couldn't go in and inspect? Suppose they decided it wasn't OSHA but some other violation of safety. You're not arguing that it was against the federal statute for them to go in and inspect.
So OSHA interprets that those activities which are regulation that are preempted as including inspection. But again, it would have to be inspection on a subject matter for which OSHA regulates. So that Section 18A would allow the state to inspect something that OSHA does not regulate. Those aren't the facts in this case. In this case, the state specifically went in, inspected on the basis of the lockout, tagout standard, the federal regulation, interpreted it, and regulated as a result of that.
Well, didn't they then issue a report finding, DWD issued a report finding a violation? And then did you request a hearing on that?
They issued a report, an investigation report, finding a violation. The DWD then issued an order to pay the penalty or appeal. Mm-hmm. We appealed, yes. I want to, if I can, I'm out of time.
You are. You may briefly state a concluding argument.
We usually say one sentence, and it turns out to be about a five-minute sentence. So give it your best shot.
All right. I think the holding in this case, the court should look to the Ben Robinson case that the Texas Supreme Court issued and hold that to the extent the state is enforcing penalties under Section 102.57 for workplace safety issues for which OSHA regulates, the state action is preempted by the OSHA. Therefore, the LERC order should be vacated and remanded to the circuit court for orders consistent with that holding. Thank you.
That was very good. Thank
you. Well under 5 minutes.
Thank you, counsel. I want to thank both Mr. Palmer and Mr. Rosamano for their arguments today on a preemption issue relating to workers' comp. We've had a lot of workers' comp cases, and this is a relatively new issue in terms of preemption, and we had a preemption case the last term that dealt with railroads in preemption. An interesting topic. That concludes our hearing in 2012 AP 2566, Sohn Manufacturing, Inc. versus LERC. That completes our oral arguments for the September calendar. And again, I can't read the clock. What does the watch
25
say?
25 to 2.
Pardon me?
25 to 4.
25 to 4. The court will meet in conference at 4 o'clock.